Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 14th, 2006. Our session today is titled, On the Road and in Many a Diner, Hanging Out with Christ. Our presenter is Fred Niedner, and the session number is NIF 2006-3. Let's listen in.
Well, welcome back to Playtime, the kind of playing I talked about on Monday. As you've learned, I'm in the pattern of giving you at least three things you can use before I get down to business, and today there are three things that maybe one or two of you here have never heard before and will find them useful. They vaguely relate to the theme of the day, but it would take too long to explain how, so I'll just offer them to you. Give a man a fish and he will eat for a day. Teach a man to fish and he'll sit in a boat for a whole weekend and drink beer. If you lend someone $20 and never see that person again, it was probably worth it. And finally, before you criticize someone, you should walk a mile in their shoes. That way, when you criticize them, you're a mile away and you have their shoes. Well, Luke has a much more obvious way than Mark for answering the question about the location and the work of the risen Christ. Because Luke is the one who tells us the ascension story in Acts chapter 1, and the way the church has learned to talk about that event and that moment is that Jesus left this time and space in order, we say, to be the Lord of all times and spaces. And the disciples live with the promise gained from those two explainers who always show up in Luke's gospel, that Jesus will come again. It's a whole lot more complicated than that, as we shall see, but that's the basic line. So we left behind ones of every generation can learn from Luke to see the risen Christ in our midst. Luke teaches us that Christ is with us all over the place, and we begin with that very familiar story of the conversation on the road to Emmaus, which I'm going to read a part of. Now, on that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and talking with each other about all these things that had happened. While they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself came near and went with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What are you discussing with each other while you walk along?" They stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, whose name was Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have taken place there in these days?" He asked them, "What things?" They replied, "The things about Jesus of Nazareth." And then you'll recall they tell this stranger the whole sad story of their shattered dreams. Then he said to them, "Oh, how foolish you are and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have declared. Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into his glory?" Then beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself in all the scriptures. And they came near the village to which they were going. He walked ahead as if he were going on. But they urged him strongly, saying, "Stay with us, because it's almost evening and the day is now nearly over." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at table with them, he took bread and blessed and broke it and gave it to them. Their eyes were opened and they recognized him. And he vanished from their sight. They said to each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road, while he was opening the scriptures to us?" That same hour they got up and returned to Jerusalem and found the 11 and their companions gathered together. They were saying, "The Lord has risen indeed, and he has appeared to Simon." Then they told what had happened on the road and how he had been known to them in the bread. Where is the risen Christ and what is he doing? Well, obviously, he can be right there on the road with us, right here on the road with us, and we might not recognize him. How can we see him? How can we know him? In the breaking of the bread. That's the big recognition moment. Well, what exactly made this guest from the road now become host at their table, recognizable to this heartbroken pair? Was it the familiar word of thanks? Was it his loaf-breaking technique, which they had watched, at Zacchaeus' house and at Mary and Martha's house and goodness knows where all in Luke's gospel? They're always stopping to eat. Or was it the sheer mystery of koinonia, the fellowship of the moment? Well, whatever it was a really big deal, at least to Luke, and here's how big a deal it is for Luke. The language of coming to recognize Jesus here in this phrase is given in almost exactly the same words that describe what happened to another couple after a conversation with yet another stranger, this time a really weird stranger, at the scene of the Bible's first meal, the one in Genesis 3. And at a critical moment, their eyes were opened and they recognized, well, this time what they recognized wasn't exactly Jesus. The meal at the end of Luke's gospel somehow stands as an eschatological parallel to that first ever meal, the one that sent us off to hiding ourselves from God and from one another so that God had to come looking for us and calling out, "Where are you?" I don't really know all that this connection of language means, but it's close enough that I doubt it's an accident. As I've indicated, conversation with a stranger begins each story. And the subject has to do with the inevitability of dying and what exactly God or God's words have said about dying. The one meal leaves us exposed and ashamed, seeking cover, and amazingly quick at shifting blame. The second meal launches us on a completely different journey. A journey not of hiding, but a journey of revealing, as we shall see. But before we move on too quickly, and lest we forget, the next words in that Emmaus recognition scene say, "And he vanished from their sight." Absence and presence have a curious relationship from this moment on. This risen one, can only be present through absence, it seems. In any case, this Emmaus pair then remembered their pre-dinner heartburn. Somewhere in their hearts and minds, the study of the scriptures in that walk-along session the stranger had taught stirred something powerful in them. And Luke's point, to say it quickly, is that if you search the scriptures looking quite deliberately for a Christ who had to suffer, a Mashiach whose death was necessary, then you can see the risen Christ to whom the law and the prophets bear witness. So these are the first two things, the meal and the scriptures, word and sacrament. Those are the keys. Sounds almost Lutheran, doesn't it? But none of this would have happened except this pair showed hospitality to a stranger. And this time they didn't entertain an angel unawares, but Christ himself. The guest became the host, and this becomes the meal that we set for strangers, one and all, whether they are estranged insiders, the simul justus et peccator we learn all about, or whether they are outsiders that we hardly know. All are welcome. So let's build a retreat center up here on the hill by the creek that runs through Emmaus. We'll stay here and entertain strangers whenever they show up. And mercy, do strangers ever show up. But no, the Emmaus pair and we, along with them, go back on the road, even after a long day and in the dead of night. Indeed, most all of Luke's gospel happens on the road, or as Luke would put it, on the way. And if I had a whole hour rather than 20 minutes, I could maybe show you that Luke's entire long story of the road show that we call the journey to Jerusalem is, in fact, the ascension of Jesus, who leaves this time and space to become Lord of all times and spaces, but who now appears in this world clothed in those who follow on his way. Briefly, in Acts 1, when the two figures who do all that explaining tell the bewildered followers who have witnessed Jesus' disappearance, "This Jesus who has been taken up from you into heaven will come in the same way as you saw him go into heaven," their word for that taking up, analemphthes it is in the Greek, does not name or refer to that thing that happened just a moment before, the method of his disappearance as the cloud hid him from their view. But this word, this taking up word, is the one that the narrator in Luke uses all the way back at chapter 9:51, when we're told when the days drew near for him to be taken up, analemphthes, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. So everything from chapter 9:51 all the way to Acts 1 is the taking up. And that whole thing is what we're going to see again. In other words, it's that road journey that includes us that we'll see again. And that's the way this one comes back. This is the secret of discipleship in Luke. The risen, ascended Christ makes his appearance in the world, clothed in those who follow, who set their face to Jerusalem. Jesus says, "If any would come after me, take up your cross." Only here he adds a little word, as many of you know, that isn't in the other calls to cross-bearing in other gospels. "Take up your cross daily and follow me," says Luke. And at the end of Luke, we get to see what daily cross-bearing looks like when the execution squad taps Simon of Cyrene to carry the cross for Jesus on the way out to Golgotha. Only here again, Luke adds a little word to give us a slightly more vivid picture. He says that Simon was to carry that cross behind Jesus so that we could see clearly Simon walking in Jesus' footsteps, following Jesus, carrying a cross. Maybe Luke thought we wouldn't get the picture. So Jesus will now conduct lessons in daily cross-bearing for Simon and the rest of us who follow along. Lesson one, in Luke and only in Luke, Jesus stops to talk to those who are wailing and lamenting his fate on the road out to Golgotha, and he says to them, you'll remember, "Don't weep for me, but weep for yourselves and weep for your children." Lesson two, As the nails are pounded into his flesh, in Luke and only Luke, Jesus says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Lesson 3, Jesus speaks now to the fellow condemned. In Luke and only in Luke, a conversation is struck up about the future of these fellows. And Jesus says to the one, "Today you will be with me in paradise." And then we realize that we've been seeing this kind of thing all along in Luke and only in Luke. This business of Jesus attending to everyone else on the way that he's going towards death. Why, back in Gethsemane, in Luke and only in Luke, Jesus had stopped the violent melee that broke out for just a moment and healed the ear of that man who lost one to the sword swinging that broke out when soldiers came. And then in the courtyard, where in Luke, everyone in the arrest party and all the hangers-on, including Simon Peter, waited for daybreak and the trial before the high priest, so that in Luke and only in Luke, Peter, when he denies that he even knows Jesus, does that even as he sits with Jesus. He denies Jesus to his face. And Jesus only looks at Peter when a chuckle, a throat clearing, a rolling of the eyes could have taken Peter down with Jesus. But Jesus only looked at Peter. These things are cross-bearing, daily cross-bearing in Luke's gospel. They are the embodiment of something totally new in this world. This is the way, the realm, indeed, this is the way the very person of Christ gets clothes and skin in Luke's gospel. Cross-bearing includes, as we note first, a form of healing ears. It's the work of living and telling a story that does not find violence and sword swinging as the solution to every problem, or to any problem for that matter. The world believes that someday, finally, the bullied victim will land a delicious smack on the jaw of the perpetrator. Won't we love that? It's how every single movie ends. But cross-bearers say, no more of this. In the face of betrayal and abandonment, the world and the flesh seek reprisal and vindication. The verb that Luke chooses for how Jesus looked at Peter on that night of denial suggests that Jesus looked right through Peter. Not just at him, but into his heart and his soul, and no words could ever say what Jesus saw there. But no matter what, Peter was still Jesus' rock, a stumbling stone, but Jesus' own. And on the road towards crucifixion, Jesus doesn't fixate on his own sorry fate, but he joins the tears of those who also suffer. Notice, please, he doesn't promise them that he can keep the mountains from falling on them, or that the mountains won't fall, but only that he'll join them when it happens. He prays forgiveness for those who execute him. You suppose they knew they needed it? Probably not. But what a life those individuals have, or don't have, doing such bloody work. Of course, they needed something. And then, the big joke. The gospel of the cross of Jesus Christ is nothing if not some kind of joke. Foolishness, our old friend Paul called it. And here we see the joke in gallows humor. "Hey, Jesus," we hear somebody yelling, "that sign says you're a king." remember me, like Joseph did the butler, or was it the baker? When you come to power, let me be your right-hand man. Jesus says, sure, friend. Today, you and me, let's do it. Well, just imagine the soldiers listening to this. Ah, these dead men walking make such jokes. But this has become my favorite image of the church. A bunch of crucified people hanging there talking about their plans. That's who we are, right? If we're serious about our lingo. We are crucified with Christ by baptism into his death, and we're still talking about the future. We have work to do. We have plans to make. That's who we are. But before anything else, we still must sing. Because finally in Luke, there comes another prayer. Or another song, really. This time, not Psalm 22, but for Luke, Psalm 31, the evening prayer, or an evening prayer among the Jews already in Jesus' day. And as some say, this snippet that he prays is the bedtime prayer that moms taught their babies, even back then, the way some of us learn, now I lay me down to sleep. I pray thee, Lord, my soul to keep. This is the perfect end to a day of cross-bearing. And at the end of our days, too, we rest ourselves, our lives, our loved ones, our bodies, and all that we are and we have with Christ in those same hands. So, for Luke, the yous of Matthew's promise includes us all right. Christ is always with us, even to the close of the age, when people will no longer hide in the bushes. But for Luke, the yous includes also the whole world of strangers and little people, the ones at your table, in whom you, at last, see the Christ, while the other sees Christ in you. Thank you.
I think we'll sing the song that we started with one more time. Let's join together.
We travel with Jesus, he carries our load. His love and his mercy are with us on the road. We travel with Jesus, he carries our load. His love and his mercy are with us on the road. We travel with Jesus, he carries our load. His love and his mercy are with us.